Two Sundays ago, when I was last with you, we dealt with the first half of what I'm calling the first servant song. And I'm borrowing terminology here. Those who have studied the book of Isaiah much more deeply than I believe that there are four servant songs. And we're going to look at those four. That may take me up close to the end of my ministry here. But today we are looking still at the first servant song found in Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 9. Last time we looked at verse 1 through 4, now we'll look at verse 5 through 9. But we'll read the entire text. Isaiah 42, beginning in verse 1. Behold, look, hearken, pay attention. Look at my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him, and he shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment in truth. He shall not fail nor be discouraged till he have set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. Thus saith God the Lord, he who created the heavens and stretched them out, he who spread forth the earth and that which cometh out of it, he who giveth breath unto the people upon it, and spirit to them that walk in it. I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thine hand, and will keep thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Looking again at this song, it is a song about this servant of Yahweh, Jehovah. We can divide it in these two halves, as we have done. First of all, in verses 1 through 4, we see what God is saying about his son, what he says of the servant. In the last part, what we'll be looking at today, in verse 9 through 5 through 9, we see what the Lord is saying to his servant. Notice, in the first part, it's a description of the servant. In the second part, it is an admonition to the servant. Last time, we saw that there's several things that God says about his servant. Number one, that he is God-selected. He's an elect servant. He's a God-sustained, upheld servant. He is a God-approved servant. He is a God-approving servant, the one in whom Jehovah is pleased with. He is a God-delighting servant. And he is a God-anointed servant, anointed with his spirit. And, of course, that's where we get the word Mashiach, Messiah, we call it, or the word Christ in Greek. It is the anointed one. God is declaring that this servant will bring his judgment into all the earth. By judgment, I think we must understand it in a broader sense than we normally would. It can mean just a judgment of a judge in a court case, and it is in a courtroom setting that we're reading these, but it seems to be that he is saying that through this servant, my rule, my right, my kingdom will be established, and he will not fail until it is established in the earth. Now, as he turns his attention to speak to his servant, in verse 5, he emphasizes who he is that he's speaking. I mean, I can say things. I can tell people to do stuff. It doesn't matter. You understand what I'm saying? How much power do you have? How much persuasive power? How much command do you enjoy? Well, here we have a description of the one who is giving this instruction to his servant. Who is he? He's the God, in verse 5, who created the heavens, stretched them out. He spread forth the earth and that which cometh out of it. He who giveth breath unto the people upon it and spirit to them that walk in it. This is who is speaking. It is the Almighty, the Creator God. He is the Lord, the Yahweh God. He is the I am that I am, the self-existent, always existing God. Remember that there's this parody going on through these chapters between God and idols. Look back just a chapter in chapter 41 in verse 6, we see idolaters encouraging themselves. Listen to this. This is how you pump up idolaters, okay? Isaiah 41 verse 6, they helped everyone his neighbor, and everyone said to his neighbor, be of good courage. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote with the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. Do you understand what this is? It's an idol factory. And everybody's playing their part. The fellow with the metal, hitting the anvil, the guy with the gold, fashioning it. Notice he said, it's ready for the soldering. And he fashions it with nails that it should not be moved. I love that last step. When you finally get through with your idol, what do you got to do? You got to stand him up and you got to nail him down so he won't fall over. You understand the humor here. That we have this contrast between man-made idols, idols that are the works of man's hands, and this I am God, the Creator of all things. And so from the beginning, it is being made clear who it is that is giving this instruction to his servant. Now, it is fascinating to me. This is one of the things I sort of mull around. When did Jesus know fully, completely, who he was? When was he self-aware that he is the Christ, the Son of God, the divine Son of God? Was it while he was laying as a baby in a manger? I sort of doubt it. In fact, we have that mysterious text over in Luke 2 after Jesus, you remember, had the encounter in the temple. His parents lost him on the trip, went back to find him. And there he clearly knows he has a father in heaven who's given him some work to do, because he says to his parents, don't you know I must be about my father's business? And yet at the same time, immediately following, he went back to Nazareth and he became subject to them. And he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with man and God. How do you explain this stuff? I don't know. I'm at loss for words. But that's the realization, is that Christ knows who he is, because here is God, his Father, telling him who is behind him. Remember what he told him earlier in the description, that he's the one who chose him, the one who's going to uphold him, take him by the hand. Here we see that now repeated to the servant in verse 6. I'm the Lord that has called you in righteousness. Now that's the second time in this immediate context we've seen this phrase. Go back to chapter 41 again. In chapter 41 in verse 2, God says he's the one who raised up the righteous man from the east. Now there the reference is clearly to King Cyrus. You understand the back story here. We have Israel going into Babylonian captivity. They're slaves in bondage in Babylon, and God is going to raise up a conqueror, King Cyrus, from the east, from Persia, who will defeat the Babylonians and free his people. And so notice that God in chapter 41, verse 2, speaks of Cyrus as his righteous servant. Here we have God now speaking to his son. And I'm taking it for granted that I prove my case that this is speaking of Jesus. If not, we might as well go home. Because the New Testament writer sure thought it was. Matthew sure thought it was. He quotes the text we read this morning in Matthew 12 and applies it to Jesus. So I'm taking that as a given that you and I as Christians believe that. But notice that now we have his son, the righteous servant. What does that mean? It means he has the right to do what he's called to do. Cyrus, God gave him the right to go conquer the earth. There are two kinds of ministries in the rule of God. One is what we would call gospel ministry, and that is the ministry that God the Father is calling his son to. There is another ministry. If you don't believe me, you don't have time, do it on your own nickel. Okay? Read Romans 12 and Romans 13 as if there's a no big number 13 there. Just read from one chapter right into the other. You'll see what I'm talking about. We are called to a ministry of mercy, of grace. But there are magistrates, as Paul goes on to say, who are called to a ministry of justice. We are not to take vengeance. God says, I will repay. Vengeance is mine. But then in chapter 13, we see that there are rulers, civil rulers, who are the Lord's ministers. That's the name given to them. Stephen, you ever think of yourself as the Lord's minister there on the job? Probably not, but perhaps you should. But notice it's a ministry of a different sort. It is not a ministry of mercy. It's a ministry of justice. And so Cyrus is being raised up as the righteous servant to administer justice. You read here. Let me read again. Isaiah 41, look at verse 25. Here's the second reference to Cyrus. I have raised up one from the north, and he shall come from the rising of the sun, that's the east. Shall he call upon my name, and he shall come upon princes as upon mortar, and as a potter treadeth clay. That's Cyrus. He's going to come as the conquering general, and he's going to step on and stomp nations and kings and princes like you would stomp on clay. But now in chapter 42, in this servant song, we see a completely different picture of another kind of servant who's not going to come in power and might with the power of the sword. He's going to come and do a different kind of ministry and do it a different way. Look at verse 6. Here God is reaffirming the things he said about his servant in the first half of this song. He's telling the servant now, I'm the one who called you. Again, back to the fact in the first part, in verse 1, he is the chosen, elect servant of Jehovah. He doesn't take this job on of his own initiative. He's the one who has been called, selected for this job. He's the chosen, called servant of God. He's going to be upheld. Notice here in verse 6, this is God speaking to the servant. I will hold your hand. You parents know what that is. Like a little child needs you to help support them and sustain them. Here God is promising support and sustaining to his servant. Do you realize in the ministry of Christ how often he'd have been dead if he had just been a mere man? I mean, he no sooner goes back to Nazareth, to his hometown. What do? They take him out, put him on that cliff to push him off. I've been there. I've seen that cliff. You don't survive that fall. They're going to push him off the cliff. Be done with him. They're so mad at him. And what does he do? He just walks through. How many times do we read that he says something and they reach down and they pick up stones to stone him? What does he do? He just walks through. Why? The scripture tells us because his hour was not yet come. It wasn't time for his suffering yet. And so in all of those, God is preserving and sustaining this servant. And then notice, I will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people. To give here in the Hebrew means the idea of fashioning, shaping something, forming something. In other words, I am preparing you for this task. And the task here is described to give the servant as a covenant of the people. That is a fascinating way that this is said. The servant is not going to come and make a covenant with the people. The servant is going to come and be a covenant to the people. You understand? Now, let's think about that a minute. What do you suppose this is talking about? What covenant do you suppose it is that the servant is going to be to the people? Now, when the word here says people in verse 6, I want you to realize that's the second time in two verses that same Hebrew word has been used. You saw it in the last part of verse 5, that God is the God who created the earth. He gave breath to whom? Unto the people upon it. There are times the word people in Hebrew in the context refers to the people of Israel. Here, that can't be so, because the previous verse has given us our scope of the people. It's anybody who's walking on the face of the earth. Is that you? Some of you aren't walking too fast, but you're still here. It's those, how does he describe it, to spirit and breath, to those that walk in it. Is that you? I mean, if you're not breathing, this isn't you. But if you are breathing, he is describing that he is the God who gives. This is the people that's being described. Now, in the very next verse, in the same context, he is giving his son for a covenant of the people. You understand the whole sense of it is that it is not just for the people of Israel. The next phrase makes that very clear in typical parallel Hebrew phrases. He's giving him for a light of the Gentiles. In other words, he's not going to be a light for Israel. He's going to be the light of the world. You see the point? And so notice that I'm giving you as a covenant to the people. Now, you say, why are you emphasizing that? Because if you take some of the statements in the Old Testament concerning the new covenant in its most literal sense, it's only made with the house of Israel. Jeremiah 31 says, God, I'm going to come and I'm going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel. So the question is, you and I talk about being in the new covenant. We talk about having the effects of the new covenant, a new heart, being born again, the Spirit of God within. Those are the things that happen in this new covenant. We use that language. We refer that to us. Are we completely out of line? We're not Jews. I'm not. By what warrant can we take this Jeremiah 31 prediction of a new covenant made with the house of Israel and apply it to us? On the basis of this verse, this is making it clear that the covenant that is going to be established through God's servant is not just for Israel. And what covenant do you suppose this is? What would you call it? I'd call it the new covenant. Because when I go to the book of Hebrews, and it might be a good idea for you to head there as well, in Hebrews, when we read then about what this servant, when he actually came into this world, what he actually did, here we have it explained in Hebrews 7. In other words, we ask ourselves, what connection does God's servant, if that's Jesus, which we certainly believe it is, what does he have with a covenant, okay? Which covenant is he connected with? Hebrews 7, verse 22. I'm just going to pick out some verses here. By so much, he's talking about he being a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, by so much was Jesus made surety of a better covenant. Look in chapter 8, verse 6. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator. Notice he was the surety, the guarantor of the covenant in chapter 7. Now he's the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. Look in chapter 9, verse 15. We change from the word covenant to testament. A testament is a type of covenant. It's what we would call a will. But it's still a covenant. It's just a subset of what a covenant might be. Hebrews 9, verse 15, for this cause, he, Christ, is the mediator of the, which one? The New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, that's the law of Moses, they who are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. Are you convinced? We ask ourselves, which covenant did Jesus, the servant of Yahweh, come into this world to establish? It's clearly the new covenant. Still don't believe me? Go to Hebrews 12. I think you believe me, but just in case. Hebrews 12, verse 22. But ye, he says, he's been contrasting two mountains, Mount Sinai, where they went up to get the law, with Mount Zion, the home of the gospel, the heavenly Jerusalem, okay? Hebrews 12, verse 22. Ye, you Christians, believers, are come unto Mount Sinai, unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are written in heaven, to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better things than that of Abel. So you understand, God is sending his son into this world to make a covenant with people, the people that walk upon the planet, those that breathe the air. They are to be brought into a covenant relationship with God's servant. Now, that solves a number of problems for us. Number one, it solves the problem of who is the elect. Now, I know there's two ways of answering that question. If we believe that there is a Lamb's Book of Life up there in heaven, we believe there are names in that Lamb's Book of Life. You believe that? In other words, election is at its heart individual, personal. God didn't choose a group. He chose you, says Paul. God has from the beginning chose you to salvation. Okay? But the question is, how do I know that you applies to me? I mean, have you seen your name in the Lamb's Book of Life? In the roll, the roster of the elect of God? I haven't seen mine. In the book of Philippians, Paul talks about some of his fellow laborers whose names are written in the Book of Life. Now, how did Paul know that? Had God given him a peek? Or is simply Paul saying, I know that not because I know it directly, but I know it indirectly from their profession of faith, from who they are, from their faithfulness to Christ. Remember, Christ is the chosen one. From our point of view, again, election is personal. It's not collective. You understand the difference? God isn't electing a group, and okay, everybody in the group, you're the elect. God is electing individual people. Okay? But from my point of view, from your point of view, you don't know the names. You don't even know if your name's in that book. How would you know that you're the elect? It's because this servant, I mean, there's one name I'm pretty sure of, and that's the name Jesus. Right? He is the elect, the chosen of God. Therefore, if I am in him, I too belong to the elect. You understand? From my point of view, that's the only way I can know my election this side of heaven. Am I in him, this elect one? Am I joined by faith in a vital union with Jesus Christ? Let me show you how Peter uses this same logic. 1 Peter chapter 2. Go to 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter here is quoting from Isaiah 28, by the way, and he's using the same analogy, but this time of a building. Stones, rocks, cornerstones, okay? You're building this foundation and this building upon it, which is, of course, the New Testament church. 1 Peter 2, where do I want to start? Verse 4, let's start there. 1 Peter 2, verse 4, to whom, that is to Christ, to the Lord, to whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious. He's quoting out of Isaiah 28, by the way. Okay, here is this chosen cornerstone. Men wouldn't choose him. They threw him out. They disallowed him. They said, we don't want him in the building. God took the stone that the builders rejected and chose it to be the head of the corner of the building he's erecting. Okay? You got this chosen cornerstone. Ye also, verse 5 now, as living stones, stones that are alive, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Okay? You are then being built on the foundation of this elect cornerstone. If that's true, if you are being joined as a brick, as a stone of a building, to this elect cornerstone, what do you suppose that makes you? Well, let's skip just a few verses, and I hate to do that. I'd love to keep it going, but for the sake of time, verse 9, now Peter turns his attention to describe you. What's the first thing he says? You are a chosen generation, a chosen people, a chosen family. You being built on a chosen cornerstone become then clearly part of that. I don't say you become chosen, but we now realize your individual election by the fact that you are resting, that you are not just stacked on the cornerstone. You are mortared into the building. You are vitally connected. I remember an old preacher telling me one time, if God sends me to hell, he's going to have to kick me loose from holding on to his leg. That's pretty good theology. We could put it like this. If God is going to send me to hell and I am joined, I'm like a brick mortared into this building, he's going to have to take a sledgehammer and knock me out of the building. If he sends me to hell and I'm like a member, a finger of his body, he's going to have to amputate part of his own body to send me to hell. You get the picture? He's the elect one. On that, I'm sure. I don't know about you, I don't know about me, but I know about him. And if I am joined vitally, spiritually, as one to him, as a husband and wife in marriage, joined together, then whoever he is, whatever he is, becomes me. You understand? It solves that problem. You won't know whether you're elect. Get in Christ. Get in him. And all that that means. How's this going to happen? Notice this covenant. And notice we've got a little change of figure in the last part of verse 6. That he's going to give his servant as a covenant of the nations for a light of the Gentiles. And this, the next verse makes plain, shows us the way this servant is going to conquer his people. We saw how Cyrus the Great is going to conquer. He's going to trample nations, princes, like you would step on mud out in your backyard. Got plenty of that around these days. He's just going to squish them. How will this servant conquer? How will he bring those into his kingdom? How will this rule, this righteous rule of God be established? It will be through him being a light. It will be through the Spirit illuminating. It will be through truth. You understand God's righteousness? Did you see that in the last part of verse 3? He's not going to fail, says God, till he brings forth judgment in truth. His people are enslaved. They're in bondage. How will they be freed? Well, verse 7 tells us. You see, problem is, Jesus being the light, number one, the light has to come to you. And you say, well, if the gospel light comes to me, then everything will be all right. No, you got a bigger problem than that. Men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. You got an external problem, the light coming to you in the first place, and you got an internal problem, a heart that is dead set against believing the light of God. Outside of that, you're in pretty good shape. But that's your problem. And so in both ways, Christ is going to come and the light go out into the world. But there's a problem. Notice verse 7. The people are blind. They can't see the light. Now, I know you're not blind perhaps in the physical sense, but this is talking about spiritual blindness. There's a problem. And so what has to happen is for Christ not only to be the light of the world, he's got to open the blind eyes, and then he brings the prisoner out of the prison. The prison is not made of steel, concrete blocks. It's made of believing lies. It's a battle of truth. You understand? And so how does he save his people? We know how Cyrus brought Israel physically out of Babylonian bondage. He went and smashed the Babylonian empire and gave them a command, you can go home. How will Jesus do it? He will do it. Well, let's put it his way. Ye shall know the truth. And what? The truth shall make you free. It will be through believing this light, receiving this light, having my eyes open by his power to be able to perceive and see the light of glory in the face of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Oh my, a different kind of conquering, is it? It's a different kind of servant. It's a different kind of minister. And then notice verse 8. God tells you here what he gets ticked off about. You say, what is it that rattles God's feathers? And I'm using an anthropomorphism. I know God doesn't have the reactions of emotion as like we do. But if I asked you, what is number one on his hit parade? What is the chief thing that is in conflict with the ways of man as opposed to the ways of God? And here we see it very clearly. He says, my glory I will not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. What is highest in the estimation of God is that you and I see and behold his glory. And when we say, well, we'll give you a little bit of glory, but we're also going to take some for ourselves, or we're going to give it to this idol over here, which the idol, by the way, since you made it, is really giving the glory to you. You do understand that. You're the one that fashioned it. You're the one that made it in the first place. And so what God is saying here is, I am not going to share my glory with another. You say, why not? Because folks, it ain't right. He is the maker, the author of all. All things are of him, through him, and to him. Therefore, all the glory belongs to him. And that is the conflict. Man wanting to get in on the action. Man wanting to steal and rob some of the glory to be able to say, I did it. I did it my way. And notice that what is being implied here is something that is opened up more fully in the New Testament. That whatever this work is that God is doing through his servant, it won't be a work that gets shared with man. It will be a work that God and God alone get the glory. And I can take you to a half a dozen passages in the New Testament to show you that. Of him are ye in Christ Jesus. Why? That no flesh should glory in his presence. Not of works. Why? Lest any man should boast, should glory. Do you understand? This is the central point of friction between us and our God. This is the origination of sinful actions. And if ever we're to be saved, we're going to have to be saved in a way that when it's all said and done, we say, to God and God alone be the glory. If you hadn't come there, you're not saved. That simple. Because that is what God is doing through his righteous servant. And then finally, verse 9, behold, the former things are come to pass. New things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Remember, that was what he was taunting the idols back in the last part of chapter 41. He's saying to these idols, come on, show up in court. I want you to make your predictions. I want you to make your prognostications. Do something. Say something. Anything. Let's have some way to test whether you're really a God or not. Just do something. And then at the end, he's saying, you're all a bunch of vanities. You're all a bunch of nothings. Okay? Now we have a God instead of the idol who is dumb, who cannot speak. We have a God who is uttering things that are new long before they unfold. In fact, about 700 years from the time of Isaiah till the unfolding of these things in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Long before they happen, I'm telling you what's coming. I'm telling you about a new thing. It's not the old thing. It's not the former thing. And by that, I understand as the New Testament unfolds this, it's not like the law. It's not that system. It's not the Mosaic system. It's a new system. You say, well, how would you describe it? Well, it's like putting new wine in a new wineskin. It's like putting new cloth on a new garment. It's like being made a new creature in Jesus Christ. It's like having a new heart. You understand? I didn't read verse 10, but if you glance on down to it, once the song is over, now Isaiah responds, sing unto the Lord a new song. I mean, he's doing this new stuff. Let's sing him a new song. We think a new song, that's just it's a new song of the same type. That's how we generally think of that. No, this is not a new song of the same type. This is a brand new kind of music, you see. But that corresponds to the new stuff that Jesus is doing. This new work that is coming. The old covenant is passing away, says the book of Hebrews. It's waxing old. It's about to vanish. There is this new thing that God is doing through His Son, Jesus Christ. And if you want to know a good reason why I don't believe in singing exclusive psalmody, you know what that is? There are certain churches that believe that the only songs we should sing are the Psalms out of the book of Psalms. And the problem with that is that if that's all we sing, then we never really sing this new song. We never sing of Jesus. We never sing of His cross, of His sufferings, if all we're doing is singing out of the Psalms. That what this is telling us is that our music and our joy ought to correspond to this new thing that God is doing through His Son. That's a pretty good way of describing what we and who we should be. God says in the book of Revelation, behold, I make all things new. I mean, we're waiting, hope you are, on a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. I hope there is a new song in your heart. You want to know what that song is? Let me read Revelation 5 and we'll end with this. In Revelation 5, we have the scene of the throne of God Almighty, the Lamb on that throne who has taken the scroll and opened it. In verse 8, Revelation 5:8, when he had taken the scroll or the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of incense, which are the prayers of saints. And they sang a new song. Here's that new song that's supposed to go along with the new stuff that God is doing. Thou art worthy to take the book. They're talking to Jesus. You're worthy to take the book, the scroll, to open its seals. For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. It's the new covenant song. The song of our Savior, our Redeemer, who bled and died for us. In Revelation 14, we get another glimpse. In verse 1, I looked, and lo, a Lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having their Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters, like the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sang, as it were, a new song. before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. This is a song that the lost man can't sing. You say, well, just play it. Let me hear the tune. I'll catch on. No. We're not talking about that kind of song. We're talking about the music of the soul, the praise and the glory that now reverberates to our God in heaven through His Son, Jesus Christ, for the fact that He has redeemed us by His blood, that we are His blood-bought people. That is the heart and soul of this new song. Oh, that might be true of you today, that you understand that God is sending His servant to do a work that only this servant can do. You are as helpless as a sinner as Israel was as a slave in Babylon. You cannot break the chains of your master. You are utterly dependent on some conqueror coming and defeating the power that grips you and setting you free. And that is what Jesus Christ has done for us. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And they went on to say, oh, we've never been in bondage. You can't be talking about us. We've never been anybody's slave. And Jesus replies, you're of your father, the devil. When he says jump, you say how high. That's how much of a slave you are. Until someone who can come along and break the claim, the grip of Satan on your soul, till someone can come and take away the legal right that Satan has to you, the sin that you've committed, God's judgment against it, till someone can come and pay the price to justice that you, the condemned rebel, might go free. You'll be there enslaved forever and ever. But God has sent His servant to do for us what only He can do. Oh, go to Him. Flee to Him. I hope these things are coming together for you as we look at this first of the servant song. There's three more to come, and we'll be dealing with each of those beginning the second one next week. But may I remind you of one other thing. Along with this new age, this new thing God is doing, this new testament, new covenant, of whom our Savior is the mediator, the surety, the guarantor, there's new ordinances. New ways by which we let people know that we are part of His people. We read about it when we partake of the Lord's Supper, don't we? This cup, said Jesus, is what? The new covenant, the new testament in my blood. You want to know what covenant He came to establish? It's that one. The one established in His own blood. And in the ordinance of baptism, we have a new way of confessing and displaying our faith before Christ's people, of coming public with what Christ has done for us. That is what we're going to be celebrating today.